Thank you for being here. Good morning. I want to tell you a little bit about what I want to cover today. I'm going to talk about the recent history in the field of disarmament. I want to talk about the movement that has been mounting in the last 5 or 6 years by the international community to prohibit or make nuclear weapons illegal. I want to talk a little bit about the plans of our government to modernize our nuclear arsenals to make them even better than they are. And then I want to raise some questions about the concept or the doctrine of nuclear deterrence. So, but a few introductory comments. I'm not an expert in this field, but it has been a lifelong concern and passion, the problem of nuclear weapons. But it's a very complex, confusing, and at times mystifying subject. So I invite you to listen with a critical ear, and when you have questions or comments along the way, let's interrupt me, and we can deal with those as we go along. We don't have to wait until the end of the hour. Secondly, the topic today, which involves weapons of mass destruction on a horrendous scale, is very heavy with darkness, which is one of the reasons I think it's avoided so often in public discourse. But there are some cracks in the darkness with light shining through, and I will try to emphasize the light when I can. First, let's look at the overall context. So let's look back a little bit at the overall context. Many contemporary commentators are now asserting that we have entered the second nuclear age. Now, we're all familiar with the first nuclear age, the nuclear arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States, the Cold War. And when the Soviet Union dissolved back in the 89 or 90, whenever that was, many of us breathed a sigh of relief. We thought that we no longer needed to be worried about nuclear annihilation. And with regard to nuclear weapons, we went to sleep. And it's just been in the last 10 years or so that we have been so rudely awakened by the specter of a renewed nuclear arms race. But more on that later. So let's go to the first, the next slide. So, the high point of the nuclear weapons arsenals, after we had gone through a frenzy of bomb building, both the United States and the Soviet Union, over about 3 decades, we had accumulated worldwide an inventory of about 70,000 nuclear warheads. 40,000 in the Soviet Union, or by the Soviet Union, and 25,000 by the United States. That number started to decline, started to reduce the arsenals dramatically in the late 1980s. It accelerated in the 1990s and with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, slowing in the 2000s and now plateaued in this decade. So that currently we have approximately worldwide about 15,000 warheads. Let's go to the next one. I mean, here you can sort of see both the U.S. arsenal and the Soviet arsenal combined at the peak around 85 or 86, there were about 70,000 weapons. Next slide. This sort of gives you the current breakdown of around 15,000 weapons. 95% of them are held by Russia and the United States. And then the other nuclear-armed states follow on with much lower numbers. So let me digress with a kind of a personal anecdote. Back in 1983, my then wife and I were becoming alarmed by the Reagan administration ramp up of the arms race, the plans to deploy the missiles, Pershing II and cruise missiles in Europe. And that was the time of the nuclear freeze movement. Everyone was, well, a lot of people were very alarmed. That was when Jonathan Schell published his book, Fate of the Earth, in the New Yorker, where he really spelled out the horrors of a nuclear war. Anyway, we got together with some friends, mostly artists, and we formed a group, why don't you go to the next one, called the Bay Area Artists for Nuclear Sanity. Next one. And we were concerned, we wanted to somehow make a statement and get people thinking about the absurd levels of nuclear weapons that then existed. And we adapted a graphic design that depicted the level of overkill in the world's nuclear arsenals at that time. And so this is what we came up with. And this graph uses the metric of the Hiroshima bomb and the total firepower of World War II as sort of the units of measurement. And one dot represents 200 Hiroshima bombs, the explosive power of 200 Hiroshima bombs. And it also, that amount of firepower was thought to be the total firepower released in World War II. Then the physicists calculated that one of these squares, which contained about 30 dots, would represent the amount of firepower that would extinguish the Earth, would basically end life on Earth as we know it. With that representation in mind, then you fill out the rest of the squares to represent the total accumulated firepower in the world at that time. Somehow we were, I don't know how we got there, some kind of insanity. We were following the rule of parity. We thought that if the Soviets had 100 more bombs, we needed 100 more. If we got 100 more than they did, they needed to catch up, and so on. So we took this graphic and we raised some money and we put it on billboards around the Bay Area and on top of taxi cabs and the sides of Mooney buses and in BART cars. And we were doing this all in the run-up to the 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco, hoping to make people wake up. So now we have reduced this arsenal dramatically. If you extrapolate and try to calculate how far we've reduced the world nuclear firepower, why don't you go to the next one? We have probably reduced it by leaving that much. But we still have a bit a ways to go. Things, even though we have smaller arsenals now in 2017, a number of people think that the danger of a nuclear explosion is more serious or more grave than it was during the Cold War. And this point of view was really brought to the larger public's awareness in 2007 when four elder statesmen, you can go to the next slide, please. Four elder statesmen of the Cold War, George Shultz, William Perry, Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn, published some op-eds in the Wall Street Journal starting in 2007, in which basically they said that we're in a second nuclear age, and the danger of an actual eruption of nuclear conflict is greater now than it has ever been. This was quite a remarkable turnaround for these three people who had been integral to the Cold War thinking during the main parts of their career. They were all retired at that time. Next. There were other signs of hope, other kindling of hope, with the election of President Obama. 2 or 3 months after his election, or his presidency starting, he delivered a famous speech in Prague, April 5th, 2009, and declared that to put an end to Cold War thinking, we would have to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy and urge others to do the same. And he declared America's commitment to seek peace and security in a world without nuclear weapons. And he so enlivened the hope around the world that something new, something was going to change, that he got the Nobel Peace Prize shortly thereafter. And he did set out to try to fulfill this kind of vision. He had a very, even though a lot of people dismissed his statements as idealistic or unrealistic, unattainable, he did have a threefold program or approach that was pretty practical. The first part of it had to do with trying to reduce the possibility of nuclear terrorism, of a terrorist group getting their hands on nuclear materials and making a bomb. And he did this by having four successive meetings of world leaders called the Nuclear Security Summits, beginning in 2010 and concluding, I think, in 2014 or 16, I'm not sure which, where he brought together 50 world leaders, and they really worked on trying to secure nuclear materials that were floating around in over 40 countries around the globe. All you need is something like 50 kilograms of enriched uranium to make a bomb, a Hiroshima-type bomb. And that would be enough to put in a sack of sugar container. So that was one of the three approaches. He also set in motion efforts to curtail the proliferation of nuclear weapons and focus mainly on Iran. We know a lot about that story. And the third approach that he took had to do with further reductions in the nuclear arsenals. And he felt that this was necessary not only to make the world safer in itself, but to create the conditions that would foster international cooperation that would then help to secure nuclear materials and also to reinforce non-proliferation. But sadly, attempt to fulfill his vision of a nuclear-free world was thwarted. Even before the treaty, well, what he did is he did negotiate a treaty with the Soviets called the New START Treaty in 2010. And that treaty had both countries, Russia and the United States, draw down their arsenal, their deployed weapons to 1,550 weapons, warheads per country, by 2018. But before he even was able to negotiate that treaty, 41 senators in Congress had written him a letter saying that further reductions of the nuclear arsenal would be acceptable only if accompanied by a significant program to modernize our nuclear deterrent. And there was a lot of opposition to the treaty, to the ratification of the treaty once it got to the Senate. And it wasn't ratified until the last day of the session with 71 votes. And it was ratified only on the condition, on the promise that they extracted from Obama to modernize our nuclear weapons over the next 3 decades at the projected cost of $1 trillion. And it was sort of a guarantee that nuclear weapons are here to stay. So I call this the Obama's Faustian bargain. Now maybe those terms are unfair because Obama didn't sell his soul to the devil, didn't sell his soul for knowledge and power, but I think he did trade his hope for a nuclear-free world for the ratification of that treaty. A few years later, in June of 2013, Obama gave a speech in Germany announcing plans to unilaterally reduce our nuclear arsenal by another third, down to 1,000 deployed weapons. However, that plan went nowhere, and it's still on hold. Meanwhile, with the evolution of Vladimir Putin's power in Russia, Russia seems to have turned away from efforts to pursue further reductions. Yes?
What does the term modernized mean?
Okay, well, can we get to that a little bit later?
Absolutely.
Okay. Next slide. Meanwhile, one of the four horsemen of the nuclear apocalypse, as I call him, William Perry, who had been a Secretary of Defense under Clinton, has been coming out very vigorously declaring the increased dangers of nuclear weapons. And I recommend his book highly. It's called My Journey at the Nuclear Brink. And it's sort of autobiographical, but it also deals with all of the issues that we're discussing. But he is very clear in his position that the nuclear danger today is more acute than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he has created a 10-week course, online course, that you can access through Stanford, called Living at the Nuclear Brink, in which he's trying to educate the younger generation about the dangers. And in the summary of that course, I'll read some of his words. He says, most people believe that the danger of a nuclear catastrophe ended with the end of the Cold War. In fact, the probability of a nuclear bomb being detonated in one of our cities today is greater than during the Cold War. The consequences of even one such bomb would be devastating. Casualties hundreds of times greater than 9/11, and social, political, and economic consequences beyond our imagination. Yet most people remain unaware or unconcerned. Today we are facing the possibility of a nuclear bomb being detonated by a terrorist group, the possibility of a regional nuclear war, the possibility of facing an accidental nuclear war, and the possibility of a nuclear war by miscalculation. because most people do not understand just how serious these dangers are today. Their governments are not taking adequate preventive actions, actions that are readily available. As I'll mention later, he doesn't really think that one superpower is going to deliberately attack another, but he does think that we might easily blunder into a nuclear war through accident, miscalculation, or via a terrorist attack. And he maintains that our land-based ICBMs, ours and the Russians, are the most critical possible cause of accidental nuclear war because of their short, less than 30 minutes, use them or lose them, launch time. And he argues that we should take them offline and dismember them, dismantle them. Next. So let's move on to the next one. So, is there a question? No. I wanted to pass one of those because I passed it already. So there's been a surge in the last 6 or 7 years of what I call countervailing voices. There was a very important Red Cross, International Red Cross report in the spring of 2010, which shocked a lot of people. And basically the report said, by our lights, by Red Cross understandings, there's no way we could ever respond to a nuclear detonation, like a major city like Washington, D.C. being obliterated by a Hiroshima-sized bomb. There's no way that we could evacuate, triage, or come to the aid because of the enormity of the destruction. And then, following the 2010 review conference for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a group of countries, Norway, Austria, Ireland, and New Zealand, refocused attention on the, what do they call, the humanitarian dimensions associated with nuclear weapons. And soon thereafter, another group of officials and activists decided to start a diplomatic process casting the issue of disarmament in terms of an humanitarian imperative. And they set up a series of conferences. Next. So there subsequently were three international conferences on the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons. First in Oslo, Norway, 2013, 126 nations represented. Next year in 2014 at Nayarit, Mexico, more nations, 147. And then finally in December of 2014 in Vienna, 158 nations. And there were also a broad range of what they call civil society organizations and groups that were part of those conferences. And they focused on the short and long-term consequences of nuclear weapons, the impact of nuclear testing, the drivers that could result in a deliberate or inadvertent use of nuclear weapons, the norms under international law. And what grew out of these conferences was a consensus that the humanitarian consequences are far higher and graver than anyone had imagined. So, one of the interesting developments, next, in the run-up to the Vienna conference, Pope Francis sent a message stating that the Vatican is no longer able to view the practice of nuclear deterrence as moral. In the past, there have been statements by the Vatican that have kind of accepted the concept of nuclear deterrence as a necessary necessary evil in this world. I'm not sure how it was framed. But his letter included this statement: nuclear deterrence and the threat of mutually assured destruction cannot be the basis for an ethics of fraternity and peaceful coexistence among peoples and states. The youth of today and tomorrow deserve far more. Well, it is kind of a mild statement, I think, but it still gets the point across. Next. Another important development that was shared or presented at the Vienna conference was a new take on the danger of nuclear winter. The concept of a nuclear winter was first brought to the public's attention back in the 1980s by Carl Sagan and other scientists. And in recent times, the danger of nuclear winter has been poo-pooed by a number of people, and it's been suggested that, well, it's really not so serious. You'd only have a problem with a nuclear autumn following a nuclear war. But the research done by this fellow, Michael Mills, of the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and others, differs significantly with that approach, and they've actually, their calculations indicate that the consequences of even a small war, say the detonation of 100 small nuclear weapons between Pakistan and India, would result in global atmospheric effects over a whole decade or more, causing catastrophic famine and attendant societal chaos affecting a billion or more people. Next. So this is one of their projections of the reduced global the reduction in food production that would be caused by reduced global temperatures, precipitation, and sunlight. Not just for a year or two after a nuclear event, but for 5 years and then 10 years. So what they discovered was that the particulate matter, the soot, and all of the stuff that is pushed up in the atmosphere by the burning of cities and forests, and would get into the higher layers of the atmosphere, higher than they had thought, and last longer, up to a decade or more, and result in widespread food crop failure and famine, killing millions and millions of people and basically putting the world in a state of total chaos. Next. So this is one of the graphs from that research, and it shows I won't spend much time on this, but it shows that the Indian-Pakistan scenario shows a small number of explosions resulting in a fairly small number of tons of soot in the atmosphere, but still enough to cause 10 years of profound disruption of world agriculture and basically life as we know it. But if you were to have a full-scale war between the United States and Russia caused by miscalculation or whatever, the nuclear winter effects that would result are staggering and far dwarf the results of a smaller exchange between India and Pakistan, which would still be devastating. Next. And finally, this is one more of their graphs showing the
below freezing for many years in the winter. So this is sort of the normal fluctuation of temperatures in a mid-latitude country like the Ukraine. But you can see that the projection is that temperatures after a nuclear or temperature wouldn't rise above freezing.
Very much. Next. So, following this Vienna conference, or at the end of the Vienna conference, 127 nations formally adopted a pledge that they had formulated to, quote, fill the legal gap for prohibition and elimination of nuclear weapons, and to cooperate with all stakeholders to achieve this goal. And they took this pledge to the United Nations. A year later, in December 2015, this pledge was adopted in the General Assembly of the United Nations by a vote of 139 votes. And so the General Assembly voted to establish what they call a special working group mandated to develop legal measures, provisions, and norms for achieving a nuclear-free world. They called that group the Open-Ended Working Group. And that group met three times in 2016, last year, February, May, and August. And that they developed a recommendation, which they took to the General Assembly in October, and it was passed in December, just 6 months ago, to hold a conference, a negotiation conference in 2017 for the purpose of drafting a legally binding instrument to ban nuclear weapons, leading to their elimination. And this recommendation was adopted by 107 states. Next. This is a list of the nations that adopted the, actually it was 126 altogether, nations in favor of a negotiation conference on a ban treaty, a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. That's, well, I'll refer to it as a ban treaty. And what is interesting, I mean, this is, it's interesting to me that one of the nations is North Korea. And I don't understand what was involved there. I haven't read anything. I haven't found anything that explained how they were there. Next slide.
The United States is not a member.
Oh, no. The United States is not. Pardon? Question? So, the nations voting no on having negotiations, 35 nations, all of the NATO nations, I believe, except for the Netherlands, the United States, all of the five members of the Security Council who are have nuclear weapons, France, Russia, United States, United Kingdom, and Israel, also a nuclear-armed country. Next slide. Those abstaining included China, India, and Pakistan, the other nuclear-armed nations, and a few others. And some didn't show up. next slide. So, the negotiation conference has gone forward. The first session occurred in March of this year, March 27-31. The second session is scheduled for June 15th through July 7th, this month. And the draft treaty has not been released or formulated yet completely, but some of the initial basic principles are these. The preamble will anchor the ban treaty in the humanitarian motivations that gave birth to it. The treaty will stipulate that no state can join the treaty and at the same time possess nuclear weapons. And the non-proliferation treaty only prohibits possession of nuclear weapons for non-nuclear armed states. The ban treaty must categorically prohibit the stockpiling of nuclear weapons by all parties without discrimination. And it is felt that the power of the treaty lies in its ability to pressure nuclear-armed or nuclear-reliant states to change their practices and policies in order to facilitate the elimination of nuclear weapons in the future. A nuclear-armed state that has decided to eliminate its nuclear arsenals could do so by negotiating a protocol with the banned treaty parties with agreed time frame and verification arrangements. So the crux of the banned treaty effort, in my way of thinking, is an act of courage and hope on the part of the vast majority of the nations around the globe to stand against fear and inequality, to stand up to power and the threat of violence, to challenge the nuclear armed states that have decided that they, and only they, have the power and authority to determine if, when, and where they will eliminate nuclear weapons, to set in motion a transformative process that will open space for future negotiations on nuclear disarmament and related verification measures, and in time, change nuclear weapons policies and practices toward complete elimination. Overall, the crux of the treaty is to take possession of our own collective destiny, to decide what sort of life we wish to live in and what sort of legacy we wish to leave our future generations. Next. So more things can be said about the rationale for the treaty. Nuclear weapons are the only weapons of mass destruction not yet prohibited by comprehensive and universal, in a comprehensive and universal way. Biological, chemical, anti-personnel, mines, and cluster munitions have all been prohibited universally by treaties. The vast number of UN nations believe that nuclear weapons must now be placed on the same legal footing as other weapons of mass destruction. And there are other points, one of the main one being that progress on nuclear disarmament has stalled in recent years. And things are moving in the opposite direction, with nuclear-armed states investing heavily in the build-up and modernization of their nuclear arsenals. Let's go to the next. So, who are the leading nations behind the banned treaty? Well, there are many. Austria, Brazil, Ireland, Mexico, Nigeria, and South Africa played critical roles. Many have raised the question, can the treaty be blocked by the nuclear weapons states or by the UN Security Council? And the answer is no. No nation has the power to block the negotiations. The treaty is not subject to approval by the UN Security Council, where the nuclear armed states yield a veto. Next. These are the nations participating in the negotiation conference. I don't expect you to read all of that, but it's just I'm impressed by the magnitude and the multiplicity of people around the world who are concerned about this. I don't understand why Finland and Greenland aren't there. Sorry?
What about Italy?
It's not there? I don't know. Let's go to the next slide. Um, Italy is one of the NATO nations. None of the NATO nations are participating, except for the Netherlands. NATO is considered a nuclear alliance, so that presumably if a nation would have to withdraw from NATO or somehow declare that they would not participate in NATO's nuclear plans and activities to be part of the treaty. But there's nothing to prevent any of these nations from joining the treaty if they commit to eliminating their nuclear weapons and have a plan and an agreement on how to do it and when to do it and so on. It's interesting that the NATO membership now includes Montenegro, which I added at the last, just joined up, you know, in April, I think. And we all know how our president pushed aside the ambassador from Montenegro to get out in front. Next. So there's been very little notice that I've seen in the media in our country covering this conference process. The New York Times had an article on the day after it started. Reuters ran a story in which they quoted our UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, who said, quote, "You're going to see almost 40 countries that are not in the General Assembly today. In this day and time, we can't honestly say we can protect our people by allowing the bad actors to have them, i.e. the nuclear weapons. And those of us that are good, trying to keep the peace and safety, not to have them." I guess it's not surprising that there hasn't been much coverage of this. It's disappointing, but maybe I just have missed it. Next. It's also interesting to review the reasons that various nations voted no or abstained on holding these negotiations. And there were about 25 or 30 statements that were given, and I looked over them. A common theme was that there was a belief that the nuclear weapons ban treaty would be ineffective because none of the nuclear armed states or the nuclear reliant states were participating. It was also often asserted that the ban treaty would undermine or weaken the non-proliferation treaty. Many nations were also concerned or objected to the conference decision to adopt a decision-making process based on voting and rejected a consensus rule. They thought that without the consensus rule, you would weaken any kind of obligation that the binding quality of obligations that would result from being a part of the treaty. However, I think the people in the conference felt that if you had a consensus rule, you would never reach an agreement because any nation or small group of nations could refuse to join the consensus and stall the process. They didn't want that to happen. Why don't we go to the next one? The most strident objections came from Russia. They felt that the ban treaty initiative was destructive and treacherous. They also asserted that pursuant to the non-proliferation treaty, nuclear weapons, which are in the possession of five states, are absolutely legitimate. And that's sort of a strange understanding of the non-proliferation treaty, which we'll get to later. Next. The United States gave a more nuanced objection, but the crux of it came down to the notion that we don't have the right international security environment to pursue elimination of nuclear weapons. it's not that we lack legal instruments, but the current political, technical, and security realities have resulted in a more uncertain security environment. And I guess that means we're still at odds with Russia and China. Next. My favorite response was from Sweden, and they voted in favor of the negotiations. They basically are dissatisfied with the deadlock in recent years in progress on nuclear disarmament. They think that the humanitarian perspective has now become a dominant consideration that everyone has to pay attention to. They also say that the issues are very complex, and they actually don't know if the Van Treaty process will lead to nuclear disarmament. But they feel that the stakes are so high, we have an obligation to try, mindful of how daunting the challenges might be. They also believe that there's no legal gap within existing law, and that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty remains the indispensable cornerstone of disarmament, and that the Ban Treaty will complement and reinforce the implementation of Article 6 of the NPT. And finally, the Ban Treaty will be a clear stance against an increasingly dangerous status quo. Next. So, let's spend a little bit of time on the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Let's go to the next slide. I don't know how familiar everyone is. This treaty was signed in 1968 under Lyndon Johnson, entered into force in 1970 under Richard Nixon, from our government side. In 1995, the parties agreed to extend the NPT indefinitely, and now there's every five years there's a review conference to see how things are moving and to evaluate the action plans. By August 2016, 191 nations had adhered to the treaty. Four UN nations have not accepted or joined the NPT, and three of those possess nuclear weapons: India, Israel, and Pakistan. North Korea joined in 1985, did not comply, and withdrew in 2003. The purpose of the treaty was threefold, basically. There are three pillars. One was non-proliferation. The second was disarmament. And the third was the right to peacefully use nuclear technology. Let's go to the next slide. Next slide. Let's go backwards. Okay, good. The second pillar on disarmament contains the central bargain of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Basically, the non-nuclear weapon states agreed never to acquire nuclear weapons. In exchange, the nuclear weapon states agree to share the benefits of peaceful nuclear technology, and here, most importantly, agree to pursue nuclear disarmament aimed at the ultimate elimination of the nuclear arsenals. So this is stated in Article 6. All parties undertake to pursue good faith negotiations on effective measures relating to the cessation of the nuclear arms race, to nuclear disarmament, and to general and complete disarmament. Now, there's widespread impatience, disappointment, and the conviction that Article 6 is simply not being taken seriously by the nuclear weapons states, and basically has been violated on an ongoing basis by a lack of good faith negotiations. There have been periods of exceptions, of course, but there's still widespread impatience and disappointment, and all of the modernization plans and programs reinforce this conviction that the nuclear armed states simply are not fulfilling Article 6. Let's go forward. I don't think I want to spend time on this one. So, on the question of modernization, what does that consist of? I don't know a whole lot of detail here, except that the components of the currently authorized program are basically run the gamut of our nuclear arsenal and the nuclear triad. A new bomber, a new ballistic missile-carrying submarine, a new ICBM, a new air-launched cruise missile, a complete remanufacturing upgrade of the existing B-61 dial-a-yield tactical nuclear bomb that also adds a precision guidance kit. A new family of missile warheads, new nuclear warhead production facilities, a massive array of new large-scale intelligence surveillance command and control systems to manage all of these forces. Next. So, my question is, who is making this decision? Who are making these decisions? Who's running the show? And there was an interesting article that came out of rollcall.com, or was cited in rollcall.com, a report out of the Pentagon in February. Pentagon panel urges Trump to expand nuclear options. Buried in a report of the Pentagon's Defense Science Board titled Seven Defense Priorities for the New Administration. The report urges tailored nuclear options for limited use in order to make the arsenal more capable of limited atomic war by producing greater numbers of low-yield weapons. This is alarming because it makes the actual use of nuclear weapons appear more usable and acceptable. But there's a lot of doublespeak in these documents, I think, because the purpose and justification is still presented in the logic of deterrence. Quote, in order to deter adversaries, primarily Russia, from using nuclear weapons first. Chapter 2 of the report, Deterring the Use of Nuclear Weapons, is extremely dense with Pentagon-speak language and appears to me to be a veiled proposal to reconfigure and revamp our nuclear arms for actual limited war fighting. The presumption is that there can be winners and losers, and there's no consideration made of risk assessments, containment of escalation, collateral damage, or long-term consequences to environment or social order. Next. A couple of examples. There are plans to basically rebuild one of our dumb nuclear bombs and make it into the world's highly accurate smart nuclear bomb by giving it fancy guidance system. Los Alamos National Laboratory is going to be upgraded, and existing plutonium facilities are going to be expanded in order to quadruple plutonium pit production from 20 to 80 pits per year. Apparently the plutonium pits are the little golf ball size or baseball size chunks of plutonium that are the heart of the thermonuclear bomb. And I guess we need more than 20 a year. We need 80 a year. Meanwhile, all of the other nuclear states are moving forward with comprehensive modernization programs as well. I don't know. I know that that's been said of Russia and China and Pakistan. I'm sure it applies to all of them. Next. So the elephant in the room, in my way of thinking, one of the elephants, is the doctrine of nuclear deterrence. And the question is whether, well, is it just a leap of faith? And as one writer says, a bet disguised as a certainty. Deterrence is almost always regarded as the indisputable bedrock raison d'etre for nuclear weapons. The foundation of the justification and the necessity for the manufacture, possession, threat to use, and God forbid, actual use of nuclear weapons. And further, nuclear deterrence has been regarded as a military policy and system of unfailing efficacy. However, these defenses of nuclear deterrence, I believe, are fallacious and also morally bankrupt. They're fallacious because the proposition, for example, that nuclear deterrence has presented a war between the great powers for the past 70 years, contrary to popular belief, is not a fact. It's a hypothesis. And one that is not amenable to empirical test. We really don't know how the last 70 years were the way they were. I mean, but many people in the defense establishment claim that the reason we didn't have a major war was because of nuclear weapons. But that's an article of faith. Another reason why I think that this is a fallacious defense is that the fact that there has not been a nuclear war or an unintended nuclear explosion since Nagasaki is a result of good luck as much as from restraint or fail-safe systems. There have been a number of instances in which only good luck saved us from nuclear catastrophe. Last. On the question of the moral bankruptcy, from the humanitarian perspective, when, not if, nuclear deterrence fails, all of humanity will suffer the consequences. Prohibition should forbid any state from imposing that risk on the rest of us, regardless of the unwarranted faith that the deterrence system will never fail. And secondly, nuclear deterrence is itself a threat, backed up with the means of delivery, to inflict indiscriminate, catastrophic, and unacceptable consequences not only on an adversary, but on the rest of humanity. From the humanitarian perspective, deterrence is nothing more than nuclear terrorism. Prohibition should forbid any state from making such a threat, regardless of the rationale. One more. So, Ray, did you have a question?
I'm dismayed to see that I think the whole discussion is based on an unreal world. there's no mention even of a menace from nuclear power plants. And yet we know for sure that an accident at a nuclear power plant can cause a catastrophic result. And there's no questioning of the possibility of knowing who blew off an atomic bomb, if an atomic bomb is smuggled in or is shot from a submarine. There would be no way of determining who we were trying to deter. And finally, the very nature of war has changed, and now the primary weapon of against the United States is the suicide bomber. And one suicide bomber can carry enough explosives on his belt to kill most of the people in, let's say, a theater. And it has the advantage that it doesn't render the target radioactive. If you make your enemy radioactive, then you can't occupy his territory. So I would say that on three counts, the people who are doing the thinking are not thinking.
I agree. And one prominent leader in the anti-nuclear field, blocking on his name, President of Plowshares, says that he cannot imagine any purpose, any use of a nuclear weapon in any war or any other situation. Ray? I mean,
why? What is the difference or distinction between the five countries that are often mentioned as the major nuclear powers, United States, Russia, France, United Kingdom, China. Those five are mentioned, but they don't include the other countries like Pakistan, India, Israel. What's the difference between the five and the larger group?
Well, those five were, you might say, grandfathered into the Non-Proliferation Treaty because they had produced or tested nuclear weapons prior to January 1st, 1967, which was the cutoff date. If you had nuclear weapons before that date, you could keep them and you were considered legitimate. Everyone else after that was not. That's one distinction. Yes.
I'd like to draw people's attention to the social justice table. There's material there from a group called Tri-Valley Cares. I don't know if you're familiar with it. They're in Livermore, and they've been there for a long time protesting the Lawrence Livermore lab and the nuclear work that it does. And there is a newsletter talking about a protest in August. I'm thinking it's the 9th of August. I'm not sure. But people are more than welcome to pick. If there's only one copy now, I will leave in a minute and make more if people are interested. But it's something we can do to show our opposition to proliferation.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a question about the slide that showed the four bullets for the principles of the ban. And the fourth bullet, it sounded like that the nations who had nuclear devices, that they were expected to have a Paris Accord type thing where they set their own levels of diminishing nuclear weapons. I was wondering if I interpreted that slide correctly under the principles.
I'm not. I think that provision, that kind of situation, has not been worked out yet in the treaty as to how a nuclear armed nation could come into the treaty, join the treaty, and how to determine the procedure whereby they would divest themselves of their nuclear arms, and what kind of time frame there would be, what kind of verification program there would be.
Purposefully vague?
Well, it's vague now, but I don't know that it will continue to be vague. I hope not. But I hear your question. It's something that has to be worked out.
I wondered if the fact that nuclear weapons don't last that long, they have to be updated, was inherent in the concept that gradually the nuclear weapons would be scrapped. And isn't the idea of updating, rehabilitating them contrary to the whole concept of the treaty, that it gradually would reduce?
Yes, it is. I think that the whole concept of modernization is contrary to the treaty. I think the people in making the treaty would like people to phase them out as the nuclear weapons wear out or are no longer viable. They should not be replaced, but should be recycled into plowshares.
I want to thank you for your talk, and I think it's a very important area to have, where it's an active conversation. Two questions. One is major manufacturers of nuclear weaponry. I know we have our national labs in this country. I wonder if there are others that you would mention. I guess I want to know who's making money. And then the second one, okay, and then that will be it. Well, cyberspace and with the weaponry, sometimes I sense that this planet not enough, and so that there are various interests interested in expanding weaponry too. I don't know if you want to call it the galaxy, outer space. It's just those two questions, and I was wondering if some of the agreements that were being discussed, if you know if that is a focus or is primarily a focus in a more limited framework.
I wish I could answer the first question. I don't know who the big companies are that are cashing in, but I'm sure they're major, and they're a driving force behind this whole modernization movement. And they have their tentacles deep into Congress. And that's why many experts refer not to the military-industrial complex anymore, but to the military-industrial congressional complex. As far as outer space, I'm sorry, I don't have the answer to that.
I was sort of curious as to, if a decision is made in Washington to use nuclear, what is the process making? I mean, just who makes the decision?
Well, right now the decision to authorize a nuclear strike, for example, is in the hands of Donald Trump, I understand. Solely in the hands of Donald Trump. And there's a movement in Congress, a bill put on the table by Senator Markey of Massachusetts and Congressman Ted Thieu of California, called something like the Restraint of First Use of Nuclear Weapons. That's not the exact title, but the bill would basically take the power away from the president to authorize a nuclear strike, a first nuclear strike, and put it in the hands of Congress. Back in the hands of Congress, where it might have been, should have been from the beginning. I don't know how far that bill has gotten, but I don't. We don't hear much about it, do we?
Thank you again. Thank you so much.
These are all great.